Hi, right, good evening, everybody. Wonderful to see you all. We are ready to jump right in. We introduced last week the beginning of our new series here on ethics for the 21st century. The text we are using is Pirkei Avos, Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. I did send a link for anybody who wants it. I'll put it up. Don't worry, we'll have it. But I just want to recap a little bit. From last week, we introduced it, and that is this section of Mishnah is unique in the sense that it's not specific for law, it's not a specific topic of law, but rather it's a perspective on life. It's a way of looking at the world and specifically about human interaction, about character, about ourselves, our personal interpersonal relationships with others, and how one can incorporate those positive traits and to stay away from things that are pitfalls from us becoming the best selves that we can. So in that sense, this is more of the ethical behaviors as opposed to ritual law. That's really the overall picture. It's the study, the body of Judaism dealing with ethics and morals. And it's something that I think is sorely needed to remind not this crowd in particular, because you guys are amazing, but rather just to sensitize and ourselves that this is the challenges that we faced as human beings, and certainly that we want to grow as Jews. So I want to start, just jump right in. Again, I want to start with the introduction to Pirkei Avos, this little paragraph that is taken from the 10th chapter of a different tractate known as Sanhedrin. And it says, Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek le'olam haba. All of Israel have a share in the world to come. Every single Jew has a portion that's allotted to them to have in the world to come. We've spoken many, many times that this world that we live in is just the antechamber. It's just the precursor. It's the foyer, the foyer, sorry, that's in front of the big banquet hall. And we go through this part of that process in this world so that ultimately we can get into the big banquet, get our ticket punched so that we can go. So everybody, you're going to learn Pirkei Avos, you're going to learn all these ideas, and you're going to say, how the heck am I going to be able to do all of this? This is only for the super righteous, for the ultra pious, for the Uber tzaddikim. No, all of Israel, everybody has a share in the world to come, as it says, and he quotes the verse in Isaiah, and your people are tzaddikim, they are righteous, they shall inherit the land forever. God says they are the branch of my planting, the work of my hand in which I take pride. Okay? But let's just focus for a moment on two aspects of this, and then we'll go into the actual first Mishnah. I don't want to miss this opportunity because there really is so much to be said about it. The first two words, Kol Yisrael. It's translated here of all of Israel, all Israel. What does that mean? The simple understanding is that every single member, the individual, every single person has a share in the world to come. But if you know Hebrew and you know a little bit of the grammar of Hebrew, that's not really a correct, I don't want to say correct, that's not really the literal translation. If it meant every person of Israel, then it would not say Kol Yisrael. It may say Kol Ish mi Yisrael, every person from Israel, or Kol Echad, everyone would have a share. The phrase Kol Yisrael seems to imply something more, something different. And I guess the easiest way to understand it is as follows. There's a concept. If I live my life as a righteous individual and I've earned my place in the world to come, I have lived my life, God willing, 120 years. We all live in good health. And after that time, we pass on from this world and we come before God and he pulls up our rap sheet and he looks at it and he goes, excellent. I'm so proud. You did an excellent job in this world. You have earned your place in the world to come. That's a great way to earn your, get your ticket punched. However, I would venture to say the overwhelming majority of us don't get it that easily. After 120 years, we're going to go up there. God's going to pull up our rap sheet and he's going to first say, "What? You're here? What? What? One second. Is this the same guy or this the same lady that I gave the potential?" And you're like, "Really? You did this and that? Oh, that one's not bad, but what about, not so sure." I think that's the overwhelming majority of us. We'll have a mixture of good and not so good. How are we going to earn our place in the world to come? We may not necessarily have earned it by our own merits, which, is a little frightening if you ask me, because, hopefully we're only got to do this once. Yes, I know Susan's thinking about reincarnation and all that. However, in the optimum picture, we should be here once. Get it right, get the soul completed for its mission, why it's here, and get your ticket punched and enjoy and bask in the glory forevermore. But I think the majority of us have to worry a little bit. So, how do we get our ticket punched? How do we earn that share in the world to come? So I want to translate the words Kol Yisrael slightly differently. Not as every person of Israel, every person amongst the Jewish people. That's one understanding, but I think it's more than that. And that is there's an entity by itself called Yisrael, Israel. And I don't mean the country, I mean the people. It's not just there's individuals who comprise the entity called the Jewish people. There's an entity called the Jewish people. If you are connected to it, if you are part of that entity, which we'll talk about in a minute, then you, even on your own rights, may not have earned it, but the entity known as Yisrael has earned it for you. You are part of the big entity called Yisrael. Again, there's two ways that you can earn your place. Think of it this way. The whole, what's the famous expression? The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, right? You've heard that expression? Well, this is no different. Think about joining a minyan. You go to services and you have nine people. Right? It happens on occasion that only nine show up. Do you have the opportunity to pray at that point? Nine people are there. Can you do a prayer service? Yes or no? The answer is yes. The answer is definitely yes. But you do not have the advantage, the privilege of being considered a quorum, a minyan. You say, what's the difference? Nine people is nine people, one more, so it's 10 people. No. When it becomes 10 people, it takes on a different identity. It's known as a quorum. It's now a whole entity of, yeah, there may be 10 individuals, but it's not looked at that way. It's looked at as one whole. And the prayers go up as one. Not nine different ones as it was when it was just nine people. When there are 10, it becomes a new, it takes on a whole different identity. And therefore, there's strength in numbers. The prayers have much greater efficacy. It has a greater power to achieve what it is we're asking. Why? Because we're all together as one.
Question.
On a much greater macro level, that's the same when it comes to the Jewish people. When we join together and connect with the community known as Yisrael, we are part of another entity, not just a conglomerate of 6 million, 15 million, however many million we are. It's not just a conglomerate of 15 million individuals, but rather it's an entity that is whole, Kol Yisrael. Kol Yisrael, all that are part of Yisrael, all that are part of this entity called the Jewish people, have a share in the world to come. So even though, if you were to break it down individually, and all 15, 16 million people of this entity, none of them on their own have the merits to earn their share in the world to come, but they still all will. Why? Because the entity known as Yisrael has a share in the world to come. For me, that makes it a little bit easier, a little bit more, I don't know, inspirational is not the right word. I feel a little bit more comfortable because all I have to do to earn my share is to be a part of it. I may not be perfect. I may have my issues and I may have done things that I probably would regret. And if I had to do it again, I would try not to. But I feel good because I'm part of Israel. I'm part of Yisrael, Klal Yisrael. Now, why is that so important? So I love to give the example. You know what? Let me take this off for one second here. I love to give the example. The story is told, and I'm sure I've shared it in the past, of a college student who is in a very large lecture hall. There's probably 200 or more people taking this class. I remember for me, it was Statistics 101. It was a massive lecture hall. There were at least 200 of us in that room, for sure. And of course, you go through the class, you take your notes, you find you have your homeworks, you have your quizzes, fine. Comes time for the final. Sure enough, the professor gives out the final and he writes on the board 2 hours. That's how much time you have to complete the final. Fine. An hour and a half, he marks after 30 minutes. 1 hour left, 45 minutes, 30 minutes, 15 minutes, 10-minute warning. At this point, the overwhelming majority of the students have already given in their paper. Those who knew it was fine. Those who didn't know it at that point were like, it's not going to get any better in the next 10 minutes, so just hand it in. 5 minute warning, 2 minutes. At this point, everybody, there's one guy in the back. He's still writing away. Fine. The professor, 1 minute. Okay, time's up. Everybody. So the remaining stragglers all come up and they start handing in their final. The professor's sitting at the desk and this guy's still writing. And the professor calls out to him and he says, "Hey, time's up, buddy. Let's go, hand it in." Student looks at the professor, smiles, and goes back to writing on his paper. Professor doesn't like that and he says, "Hey, if that final's not on my desk in the next 30 seconds, not only do you get an F on the final, you're going to fail the course." Kid looks up, smiles, and keeps on writing. "Okay, thanks." Professor starts sitting there and he's marking papers in the days where professors actually marked papers and didn't give it to the RA. Fine. About 10, maybe 15 minutes later, the kid gets up and comes up to the desk and wants to hand his paper into the professor. And the professor's like, "Dude, you failed, man. Sayonara."
Middle.
The student looks to him and he says, "Do you know who I am?" Professor says, "No, and I don't really care who you are." "Do you know who I am?" "No," the professor says, "I don't really care if your parent is the president of this university. I told you the paper had to be in and you just ignored me. You kept writing." "You don't know who I am? Good." He lifts up the pile of papers, shoves his right into the middle of the stack, and says, "Have fun finding me." In a joking way, that's the power of being part of a large community. You're one of an entire massive group. The group as a whole has the advantage of going up. That's the beauty of davening with a minyan, of a quorum. Again, I'm not suggesting that a person can't pray without it, but there's something to be said about davening in shul, about going to the synagogue and being part of the tzibur, being part of the community. This introduction to Pirkei Avos reminds us that we're going to see things that are going to make us work hard. These are ethics. We all know from the lives that we lead that making ethical decisions is not always easy. It's not always popular. And it's hard sometimes to go against conventional wisdom. But that's what ethics demands. You're going to have to work hard. You say, but I'm going to mess up. Don't worry. Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelek L'Olam Haba. Continue being connected to the Jewish people, which is an entity that is trying to model ethics, that's doing its part to set the world straight for what's right and what's wrong. We have principles that we live by. Connect with that community. You have your share in the world to come. That's the first thing. The truth is, it makes perfect sense. How did God give us the Torah? The Torah, which is the blueprint for our decision making of ethics of right and wrong, we follow the Torah's guide. We were given it as a people, weren't we? Contrary to all the movies, I don't care whether it's the old Charlton Heston version or the new Prince of Egypt version, whichever way you want it, they seem to indicate that God gave it to Moses, who then gave it to the Jewish people. That's not how my Torah reads. My Torah is extremely clear. God spoke to the entire Jewish nation. Everybody heard God speak the Ten Commandments, not just Moses. We were given the Torah as an entity known as the Jewish people. In fact, the wording that the Torah uses when the Jews were encamped around Mount Sinai is said in the singular. Vayichan Sham Yisrael. Yisrael, the Jewish people, encamped there. It should be plural. It should be Vayachanu. They encamped there. But it doesn't say that. It says Vayichan, as if it were he, singular, encamped. Rashi, quoting our early sages, points this out and says, because the Jewish people standing around Mount Sinai, Ki ish echad belev echad. We're like one man, one heart. We were one entity. We were given the Torah as one people. That's how it works. It's for that reason that we are responsible for each other. We can't just say, I live my good life and I don't have to worry about any other person. Not true. If we are an entity, then we got to be, as Clint Eastwood said, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's the way it goes. You got to take the good stuff with not so good. We stand strong with the Jewish people. We are not perfect, far from it. But being connected to this community, the idea, is critically important. I want to share with you just how important it is. There's only, I believe, that in the entire Tanakh, the entire 24 books of what we call the written Torah, the five books of Moses, plus all the prophets and all the writings, there's only two places where the expression Vayelech Ish me someplace, a man went. Which man? Doesn't say his name. And a man went. There's two places in Tanakh. One is the story right preceding Moshe's birth, where it says, Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, there was a man from the household of Levi, comes from the tribe of Levi, Vayikach es bas Levi, and he took a daughter, some girl, a descendant of Levi. They were distant cousins. Okay? Fifth cousins removed, I don't know, something like that. But it doesn't give us his name. It doesn't give us her name right away. And ultimately, that we find out is Amram and Yocheved, Moshe's parents. Amram his father, Yocheved his mother. A man went anonymously. And what did he do? Rashi tells us, what do you mean? They already had two children. They already had Aaron and Miriam. What do you mean now Moshe went? I'm sorry, this man went and married this woman. Amram and Yocheved were married before. Remember, no children before marriage. Remember that concept? Right? So if there are two children, they were already married. So what do you mean a man went and he married this woman? Rashi tells us, again, Rashi quoting early sources, tells us that at some point Amram said to Yocheved, we should not be married anymore. We should not be having children right now because we're living in such difficult times. Pharaoh has all of these decrees to destroy the Jewish people, including killing babies. We should not be having children. So they decided, okay, you're right. Let's divorce. Let's not be in a position of where we'll have children. The Jewish people, following Amram and Yocheved's leadership, they also divorced their wives, and nobody was having children for a while. Miriam, this young girl, finds out about this, and she says to her parents, "Your decree is worse than Pharaoh's. Pharaoh only made a decree against boys, against males. Your decree is even against females, because what if you have a daughter? What right do you have to do that?" Amram says, "You're right." So he remarries Yocheved. And that's when Moshe is born. From that second marriage, that second union between Amram and Yocheved. A man who is trying to connect with the people. I told you there's a second place. There's a second place in Tanakh where the same phrase is found. And it's in the story of Ruth, of Rus. There, the story tells us that Yelech Ish, a man went, mi Beis Lechem Yehuda, from Bethlehem, from Beis Lechem, and he leaves the Jewish people. He leaves. Where's he leaving? So if you know the story of Ruth, if you know the story of Ruth, and that there was a terrible famine in the land of Israel, Elimelech is his name. Elimelech is extremely wealthy, and everybody's knocking on his door because they need help. Nobody has what to eat, nobody has that. And he decides, I can't do this anymore. So he takes his cattle, he takes his family, he takes all that he has, and he leaves. Vayelech Ish. He's also on a journey, but not to connect with the people, just the opposite, to separate from the people. And unfortunately, the demise that happens to Elimelech and to his children, you read the story there. They're going in opposite ways. Those who wish to connect with the community, you end up with a Moshe. You end up with a great leader that represents so much for the Jewish people. You want to separate. You want to disassociate with the Jewish people, then you're going the Elimelech route. It doesn't bode well for you. This is the critical aspect. As I used to say when I was in New York, so there was a lottery. I forgot, I think it was called the New York Lottery. I think they had a great catchy slogan. You got to be in it to win it. That was their slogan. Brilliant, right? You got to be in it to win it. You got to play it. That's the same thing with the Jewish people. You can't just say, I'm a Jew by name, or I'm a Jew because I was born a Jew. No, you got to be in it. You got to be a part of it. And when you connect with it and you're a part of it, that means you're happy when there's happy occasions and you're sad and you express it in sad situations. You're a part of it. Think of your closest friend. Why is this person your closest friend? Because you share, you connect with the person. When they have a simcha, when they have a happy occasion, you're there. You want to dance with them. You'll travel to the ends of the earth to celebrate with him or her because that's what you do. That's your friendship. And you know what? You'll go there in bad times too. When God forbid there's an issue, there's a loss, there, we go. Why? Because that's what friends do. That's what it means you're connected with the person. Same thing with the Jewish people. Kol Yisrael, as long as you are a part of the Jewish people, that means you're really a part of it. I'm not talking about religious observance. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about identifying as part of the Jewish people. Then, yes, then you have a share in the world to come, even if you yourself don't deserve it on your own. That's one point. Okay? Let's continue this though. What time is it? 8:30 already. Gosh. Okay. Let's go back to this phrase for a moment because there's a second part that I want to just bring up briefly. Again, Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek. All of Israel has a share in the world to come. A chelek means a portion, right? It's a portion of. What kind of portion? Is it a big portion? Is it a little portion? Is it what kind of portion is it? You know, when I was a kid and mom would say, you know, let's get a pie of pizza and we'll split it. And I'd be like, well, how many slices am I going to get? It sounds great, you're getting a pie, but if I'm only getting half of one, that doesn't do me any good. So what kind of share, what kind of chelek will I be getting? Well, that, the answer says the Chafetz Chaim, depends on you. You see, you can go ahead when you gave to your child. Let's say you gave them, a couple of dollars as an allowance, and you encourage them to invest it. Right? There are a lot of parents that that's what they do to try to teach their children about fiscal responsibility. So they'll give them a weekly, a monthly, whatever. They give them some kind of allowance, and they're trying to teach them to invest. They don't get it. They don't interfere, but they let the child make the decisions how and what to invest in. Sometimes, if the guidance is great, so then that initial, I don't know, $50, you bought a penny stock back in the old days, right? You made an investment. You started the kid with a minor savings account, and you trained the person, the kid, to put in $5 a week, $10 a month, whatever it is. You're teaching proper ways to invest. The kid doesn't realize it as it's growing. And the next thing they know, comes their bar mitzvah, comes the time for their wedding, comes the time for whatever it is. And the next thing they know, they had invested a couple of $100 and now it's worth a couple of $1,000. That's a smart investment. Sometimes, without the proper guidance, you take this, you get a piece of real estate, and you do nothing with it. And you let it sit there, and it grows with weeds, and it becomes overgrown, and it becomes the soil begets rotten, and you have to then invest thousands and thousands of dollars to fix it up because it's gone to pot, it's gone to waste. The Chafetz Chaim says, while it's true that everybody has a share, what's to become of that portion? What's to become? That's up to you. You have to make something out of it. All you get is a plot. You get a piece. What do you do with it? Make sure you invest wisely in this world. Make sure that that portion is not set aside for stupid things, but rather smart investments. If a person is blessed with some level of wealth, make sure you're using it smartly. Are you investing not only in businesses? Are you investing in people? I have a grand idea in my head that, God willing, I hope one day I'll be able to do. It's not going to change the world. It's not, but it'll help people in the community in which I live. I need a few dollars to do that, but I think it's something that will be beneficial. In Baltimore, they have, I think we've talked about the idea of a gemach. You ever hear of a gemach? It's spelled in English, Gemach, gemach, but it's not a real word. It's an acronym. It stands for Gemilut Chasadim. It's an acronym, Gimel Mem Chet, gemach, but it's not a real word. Gemilut Chasadim is a bestowing of kindness, but it's become a term where people have a gemach. They give out or they lend free of charge. And there's a million. If you open up, we have here in Baltimore what's called the Eruv list. It's a great resource of our community, not just phone numbers of people in the community, but it has it has advice about this, and it gives information about that, and different if you need a electricians, and it has a whole yellow pages. It's got everything. But one of the things it has is like four pages of gemachs. People like somebody down the street from me has a table and chair gemach. You're making, you have a little a get together with, and you don't have enough 8-foot tables. Who has enough 8-foot tables unless you work for Shoresh, right? You got plenty of 8-foot tables, right? But the average person has one, maybe two folding tables. Like, how many tables can you have? But you're hosting a Sheva Brachos for, somebody. You're hosting a party. This guy's got, don't worry, call me. I'm happy to do that. There's a ladder gemach. Not everybody has a 50-foot ladder. Call this guy up. He'll lend it to you, no problem. Happy to have. And there's baby formula gemachs, and they got this and bris. People like to dress the new baby for a bris in a nice white outfit. Not everybody can afford to buy a nice, beautiful white outfit. Can't afford? Don't worry. There's a bris gemach. There's a literally hundreds. The concept is very simple. You're there, invest, take some of what you have, share it with others. That's an investment. That's what it means. Take your portion and grow it. Take your money, take your time, take your knowledge, share it, give it to others. I'm not saying there are gemachs of lending money, interest free. Okay, you got to be careful. You can't just give it out. I'm not saying just willy-nilly just give stuff out. Got to be smart about it. But the point is, don't hoard everything you have, whether it's intelligence, whether it's time, whether it's money, whatever. Everybody has what to share to make the world a better place. That's what it means. So make sure you're investing in people. That's how we start. Yes? Any questions on this part so far? Excellent. Let's jump into the first Mishnah. Okay, here we go. First Mishnah, chapter one, number one. Moshe Kibel Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai, gave it over to Joshua. Joshua gave it over to the elders to the prophets. The prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. They, the men of the great assembly, would always say these three things. These are like three favorite teachings. One, be cautious in judgment. Be deliberate in judgment. We'll talk about all three of them. Number one, be cautious in judgment. Number two, establish many students. And three, make a safety fence around the Torah. Each one of these is an hour class. We're gonna get it down to 30 minutes. Okay? Each. No, kidding. Okay? We're gonna get this. We're gonna get through this. The first thing we start with is an interesting. Is a historical perspective. It's basically a chronology. How did we get to this point? Well, we all know Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai, and then he gave it over to his student Joshua. Joshua to the next generation to the generation of the prophets. Prophets continue to give it over generation after generation until you get to the men of the great assembly who lived approximately right around the time of the Second Temple. Second Temple era. And they now, from this point on, the rest of Pirkei Avos is going to start from this historical point. The men of the Great Assembly, and who were they? Who were the generations following? Before we get to what they taught, we touched on it a little bit last week. Why do I need this chronology? Why now all of it? This is not, as we mentioned last time, this is not the first book of the Mishnah. If this had been Book one, chapter one, Mishnah one, then I understand because you got to tell me, how do we get here? But this is in chapter, I'm sorry, this is in book four. Book four, tractate number seven, chapter one. I mean, it's like buried in the middle of everything. What's it doing here? So I think we touched on it, but I just want to bring it out one last time. Do I need to know that there's a mitzvah in the Torah? Do I need a Torah to teach me to keep Shabbos? The answer is yes. I don't know if necessarily I would have come up with that on my own. Maybe I would have, but probably not. Do I need a mitzvah in the Torah to tell me that I should put on tefillin? Probably. I don't think I would have come up with that one. Take a leather box. Put a few pieces of parchment inside with scrolls. I'm not sure I would have come up with that one. Do I need a Torah to teach me basic social order law? Don't murder? Maybe. I think I would lean towards yes, because the world prior to the giving of the Torah was filled with that. The Torah has had a profound impact in the world, certainly the civilized world, where most civilized societies recognize that murder is abhorrent. But there are many things that maybe I would have come up with, maybe not. But let me ask you this. Do I need to tell you that ethical behaviors need some kind of divine authority? Does
No.
the ethical behaviors, what?
Mm-mm.
You would think not, right? People, do you choose what's ethical? But Marsha, let me ask you, in Hitler's mind, did he do anything wrong?
No.
Okay, so is he wrong?
Yes.
Whoa, how are you to tell me, or him for that matter, your belief system is different than his, obviously. Who's to say you're right and he's wrong?
I would have to say that God would have to be on my side.
Oh, one second. Now you are bringing God into it. I asked you, does ethical behaviors need some kind of divine authority? You said no.
Doesn't necessarily, but it comes in handy at times.
No, now you're fudging it. No, that doesn't fly. You can't, I just cut right to the chase. Who's to say that those ethical values that a human being comes up with is any more right or less right than someone else's opinion? Ethics, by its very nature, means there are principles of right and wrong. That's what ethics are. Something that is unethical or something that is ethical means it's inappropriate, it's not right or ethical, it is appropriate and it is right. Who's to make that determination? You see, if we leave it to mankind, we run the risk of everybody doing what they think is right. Then that's not ethics, that's opinions. You're right. You phrased it in a funny way, but I think in your heart of hearts, you expressed it properly. And that is, I do need some guidance. I do need God on my side to help me figure that out. I can't just leave it up. Who's to say? Not everything is logical. Let me say it better. Not everything that's logical is ethical. Think about that. Just because I think it's right and I've come up with a logical reasoning for it doesn't mean it's right. If I went ahead, if God forbid, somebody in a, not mine, let's talk about somebody else, somebody's family member was murdered. Killed in cold blood. Logically speaking, the relative should go ahead and have the right to kill that murderer. There's a tit for tat. I can express many sound logical arguments why that's right. Yet it's still, from a Torah perspective, that's unethical. You do not have the right to do that. If you leave the decisions of what's right and wrong, what's ethical or unethical, to man, and I don't mean as opposed to woman, if you leave it to humanity, you run the risk of it not being necessarily correct. There are many social changes that have taken place over the last century that a century before that was considered not just not right, it was considered terrible. Now it's okay. How can something go from terrible to okay when you talk about right and wrong, when you talk about ethics? It's very hard to do that. If you leave it to mankind, if you leave it up to people, then it's like ties, neckties. They go in and out of fashion. You know what's in fashion? Thin ties. Wait 10, 15 years, fat ties are back in style. And you can't wear a thin tie. I don't know. Growing up, my father wore from Memorial Day to Labor Day, he wore a straw hat. That was his thing. You can't wear a straw hat in the winter. You had to wear a felt hat. Okay. But it's a rule. You can't wear a straw hat before Memorial Day. It's just not right. Anybody else had this? You know what I'm talking about? It's like an unwritten rule. You can't wear. And after Labor Day, they're going to. Oh, a shanda. Oh, terrible. How could you do that? Right? Okay. Because somebody in Paris decided it's unfashionable to wear after Labor Day. Okay. And what if, they decide, as they often do, they change their mind a few years later and they're now, you know what? Straw hats, that's the rage in January. That's all the rage. And they have it modeled down the runway. Right? I can see it happening, but oh my God, in my father's time, it was you couldn't. That's so wrong. You can't leave ethics like that up to, you need a divine authority. So when we study Pirkei Avos, it makes it clear from the very beginning. I don't need a Mishnah telling me about the fact that the laws about blessings or the laws about Shabbos or the laws about any of this other stuff. Of course, I'm going to need a divine authority on that because who says? But maybe, just maybe, I would have considered when it comes to ethical behaviors, this whole work of Pirkei Avos, maybe I could leave it up to man. No. We start chapter one, Mishnah one. These behaviors that we are now going to learn, these ethical concepts, they come straight from Sinai. They come straight from the divine authority. The same God that gave over the laws of Shabbos, the same God who gave over the laws of tzitzis and tefillin and tzedakah and yontif also gave ethical behaviors. It's the same divine authority. And that's why it starts with this. Okay. Was there a question here? Hold on. Yeah, someone had a question. Right. Okay. The same idea. Right, Susan. Correct. Okay. So let's see. They're fine. You have this chronology that starts from Sinai. But wait, I'm sorry. One more thing before we even get to the three teachings. Let's go to the first line. Moses received the Torah. What were you expecting it to say? Moses received the Torah from
God.
God. Isn't that what I would have? That's what I would have written. What a strange way to say it. Moses received the Torah from Sinai? Yes, I know it was at Sinai. You can say Moses received the Torah from God at Sinai. I'm good with that. But it almost gives the impression that Moses received the Torah as if there was a lesson from Sinai itself, the mountain. What could that possibly be? So most of us probably are familiar. Why did God, in fact, give it on Mount Sinai? Of all the different mountains that God could have given it, and there are some mountains that are taller, some mountains that are much more lush with greenery. There are many mountains that are just towering. God could have given the Torah on Kilimanjaro. That would have been awesome. Wow, God gave the Jewish people the Torah on Mount Everest. Man, that would have made a great story. Sinai. Wow, what do we know about Mount Sinai? Anyone remember their Hebrew school? Anyone remember Mount Sinai? What was its big claim to fame?
It wasn't
Exactly.
a desert.
What?
It wasn't a desert, and nobody owned that.
Okay, it was given in the desert. That's true. Different
Was
aspect. But give me the
humble,
characteristics of Mount Sinai is what?
small, humble.
Yes. Yes. It was specifically one of the smaller mountains. Yeah. God purposely gave it on Mount Sinai with a sense because to teach us to appreciate Torah, you cannot be arrogant. You have to have a sense of humility. And you know what the greatest aspect of humility, a ramification of that trait, is that you're willing to listen and hear another perspective. If you're arrogant, you have no interest in hearing what anybody else has to say because you think you know all the answers. If you come, go to a meeting, if you're in your office with a sense of humility, yes, you have an opinion. Yes, you'd like to share your opinion, but you have that sense of humility that you can hear what other perspectives are, then there's what to have a conversation with. Torah was given on Mount Sinai because it's teaching us first and foremost, we need to be humble. Listen, is it what I would have come up with? Not necessarily, but I have to learn to listen. I have to learn sometimes to accept. There has to be. You can only do that when there's humility. I saw something fascinating. Moshe, we know that Moses, when he was asked to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, we're all familiar with the story. Moses had to run as a fugitive after he had killed the Egyptian, and he's out in the country of Midian, right? And he's out there shepherding the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, Yisro. And what happens? He comes across the burning bush. God speaks to him, right? We know that famous. Moshe, I want you to take the Jewish people out from the land of Egypt. Is Moshe A, excited, B, thrilled, C, unbelievably joyous, or D, no chance and you know what that I want that job. Yeah, it's number four. Moshe is extremely hesitant. No, I'm not the right guy. I have a speech impediment. choose my brother. I mean, he tries everything. He's hesitant, hesitant. No, I can't take the Jewish people out until finally God says, hey, you the man, you're doing it. Okay. Fast forward. When we come out of Egypt and Moshe is given the task to go up Mount Sinai to receive the Torah on behalf of the Jewish people, bring down the hard copy of the Ten Commandments, and thereby learn the whole Torah, teach it to the Jewish people. Do you find anywhere that Moshe is hesitant there? Do you find him putting up any kind of resistance that he doesn't want to do that job? I'll give you a hint. No. There's no hesitation on his part whatsoever. Why the difference? Why is it that when it comes to the receiving of the Torah, the historical event of the ages, there's no hesitation on his part whatsoever. And yet, when it comes to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, he's completely resistant. One could say, one answer could be, is that he learned his lesson. He put up a fight last time. God said, I don't accept it. So he didn't bother putting up a fight this time. It's a legitimate answer, but I think there's more. I think that intrinsically, there's a difference between the two. Moshe was trying, when he was first asked as his position of leadership to take the Jewish people out, he was extremely reluctant because what do we know about Moshe's trait? What is he identified? What trait was he outstanding?
Humble.
Humble was humility. So when it came to a position of leadership, he's like, I'm not the right guy. I don't think I'm worthy of it. You can do so much better. There was a sense of humility there. However, listen to this. When it came to receiving the Torah at Har Sinai, he was going to put up a fight. But then he asked himself, why did God choose specifically to give the Torah on Mount Sinai? Oh, humility, humility. Oh, this is not a sign of greatness. That's why God gave it on Mount Sinai. Oh, this isn't real leadership. This isn't because that's not what I can go with that. Even humble people can do that. This isn't this position of greatness. Taking the Jewish people out of Egypt, he thought that this was a position of greatness and he wasn't worthy of it. Receiving the Torah and giving it to the Jewish people, that's right in line with the kind of guy God wants. Nothing to do with greatness. In fact, it has to do with humility. That I can understand. And now he's willing to do that. Therefore, there's no fight. If you think about it, it makes perfect sense. As I said to you, to receive the Torah, you have to have a sense of humility, a sense of there's something bigger, and me compared to the greatness of God, I really don't amount to that much. There has to be that sense of humility. What day on the calendar was the Torah finally given to us, the second set of tablets? Go ahead, Sandy. I can read your lips.
Yom Kippur?
Yom Kippur.
Is it Yom Kippur?
Yes, it is Yom Kippur. It's exactly what it is. The second set of tablets were given on the 10th of Tishrei, Yom Kippur, which makes perfect sense because it's on that day where we do come to grips with our faults, our failings. We ask God to forgive us, the greatness of God who's willing to give us. That puts us in our place a little bit. There is a sense of humility on Yom Kippur. If you go into Yom Kippur with a sense of gaiva, with a sense of pride and arrogance, you ain't gonna get the forgiveness you want. That's not a way you go into Yom Kippur. It has to be with that humility. So, how perfectly appropriate it is that the Torah is given to us on Yom Kippur, because that's the only way that you can move forward. Somebody once said that if you go ahead and you take a cup of water from the sea, right? Okay. It's really insignificant, right? It's only a cup from an entire massive sea. But when you have that cup, do you not have something? You have a cup of water. Yes? How about the other way around? If I take a cup of water and I throw it into the sea, how much is that cup of water now worth?
Nothing.
That's really nothing. Compared to the amount that's in the sea, you're putting in one cup just doesn't amount to anything. In Yiddish, it's garnished, nothing. As opposed to if you took a cup from the sea, while it may seem insignificant, you do have the something. Moshe looked at himself that way and said, compared to the greatness of God, my contribution in all of this is garnished. It's nothing. I'm like a little cup of water into the big sea. Sinai is that model. Compared to the greatness of what's happening, it's almost insignificant. That's exactly the message God wants. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, just geographically, but the message of what Mount Sinai is all about. Moshe was able to receive the Torah for us and bring it to us because he had the same trait of Sinai, that sense of humility. When the self steps aside, there is room for the divine. Sid, write that one down. That's a good line. When the self steps aside, there is room for the divine. That's what we have to learn. So, step number one in all of this is that we have to learn to put self aside. I know it's contrary to Kant. You guys study a little philosophy in college, KANT. Or in Brooklyn, we called him Kant, right? Kant, right? Kant. His general philosophy is man's autonomy. Man is the final authority on everything. That's not a Torah perspective. Yes, man has contributions to make, but man is not the final authority. The divine is. So therefore, Pirkei Avos begins, Moshe Kibel Torah, Moshe received the Torah, Misinai, from Sinai itself. Okay. Okay, I still have a couple of minutes. Let me quickly touch on these three ideals. The men of the Great Assembly would say three things. One, be deliberate in judgment. I think in a very simple way, in a very simple way, this is telling us that if you're a judge, you have to make sure that you are very careful. It goes without saying that if we're talking about a capital case where somebody's life is on the line, you sure as heck better be deliberate. Make sure you have examined it, all the evidence carefully. You've turned over every possible understanding, every aspect. Be very deliberate. But it's true, even if it's not a capital case and it's quote unquote only a monetary case, be very careful because putting someone in a financial hardship is also something you have to take very seriously. But the truth is, it goes even further. Even if it's not a capital case, it's not even a monetary case. It's just a simple, I don't know, religious ruling. A student comes to me and he asks me, can I do this? Is it okay? Is this the right thing to do? Shouldn't be flippant about it and say, yeah, it's fine. Be very deliberate. Is this the right answer? You have to weigh it out. Be very careful. But I've seen in other sources that this is not talking only to judges. It's talking to guys and gals like you and me. It's talking about us, every individual, vis-a-vis judging others. Be very careful in your judgment of others. We're going to talk about it more when we get to another Mishnah, but just simply, don't be so quick to judge. You don't know people's circumstances. You see people do something and you immediately, ah, how could they do something like that? It's just so. Be very cautious and deliberate in judging other people. Not so fast. You may not be aware of certain factors. You don't know the person's circumstance. Be very careful about that. And the truth is, you can take it even further and be careful, be very careful in what decisions you make about your own life. Life is to be taken, I shouldn't say the word seriously as opposed to enjoyment. I don't mean that. Life is not to be taken lightly. Decisions that we make have ramifications. Is it important for me to budget time to study Torah? Yes, it is. And yeah, are there other things vying for my time? Yes, but I'm making a judgment. I'm making a decision vis-a-vis myself. I need to continue growing as a Jew. I need to be growing as a person. Are there other decisions that I make of how I'm gonna go spend my time with other family members, whether it be children, grandchildren, cousins, aunts, uncles? Those are decisions. Where am I going on vacation? Am I going to a place that is going to improve my quality of life? Or am I going to enjoy and imbibe in things that are not necessarily in my best interest, either physically, spiritually, or emotionally? I'm not picking any particular place. But be very cautious in judgments and decisions that we make about others and about ourselves. That's number one. Number two, this one is one of my favorite lines. In English, they say establish many pupils. If you look at the Hebrew, it's a little bit different. The Hebrew uses this word, vehe'emidu, from the word amod, which means to make stand. You should cause to make stand, you should be the teacher who causes many students to stand. What does that mean? Strange term. Simply, it means number one is that just a lesson. You shouldn't hand pick your students. You should teach as many as possible. Why? Because you really don't know which student is the one that or two that are going to rise to the top. You have no idea. I have seen it time and time again. I'm living proof of it, ladies and gentlemen. If my teachers could vote back in high school, who was going to be successful in becoming a Torah teacher? I don't think I would have been in the top 10, and we were only 11 in the class. Right? It's just, you can't. So, the first thing they tell us, teach as many students as possible. You don't know who's going to be, you have no idea who's going to be inspired, who's going to be take you to the next level. You have no idea. A guy called me years ago. This is a guy, I tell you, I don't mean this in to try to pat myself on the back, only to bring out this point. You never know. This guy was not a regular. He was an older, probably at the time, he was probably, I would say, maybe young 20s, maybe upper 20s. And he came periodically. He was not a regular at all. And he came to a class every now and then of mine. Didn't think anything. He lived in the neighborhood, but didn't really see him. Fast forward about probably 10 years, 10 years. And he told me that a class that I gave, one class that he attended, made such an imprint on him. He changed what he was focused on. It made a huge impact on him. Now, I didn't even remember he was at the class. I really don't. But you never know. So therefore, teach many, many, many students. You'd be surprised. You might end up with a Tzvi Tachman one day. Who knows? Okay. But I want to go back to that word, to make stand many students. Isn't that a weird expression? Make stand doesn't mean that they have to physically stand as opposed to sit. But just like we do with children, what do we want ultimately? You know what we want ultimately from our children is that they stand on their own two feet. The job of a teacher is not to just disseminate information. It's not just to impart, the lesson. It's to give the student the wherewithal, the skill set that they can stand on their own two feet. My greatest joy as a teacher is where the student goes and moves on past me, goes to perhaps a higher level, goes to another teacher, finds themselves in a different community and attaches themselves to a different rabbi. That's my greatest joy. I don't want necessarily that they're attached to me, only me. They should learn to stand on their own two feet a little bit. That's part of the job of teaching. It's true for our children, and it's certainly true for our students. And finally, and I'll take questions afterwards, the last part, make a safety fence around the Torah. This is such an important idea. We all know that the Torah is critically important for our survival. I mean, as a people, we need the Torah. And just like anything that's of value, you want to take precautions to protect it. Most of us, in fact, I would venture to say all of us, keep our important items in the house. Either we lock it up in a safe deposit box in the bank, or we have a lock box in the house, or we have some. You don't leave your best jewelry and you don't leave wads of cash just hanging around, just out randomly in your house. Why? Because it has value to you. You take precautions to protect it. I mean, maybe I'm the odd man out here, but because I got some really strange looks from you guys. You guys, I mean, I'm happy to come by if you have some extra wads of cash just sitting around that you don't care about. Or my wife's birthday's coming up. I'm happy for it. Right? Of course, you want to make sure that you take care of that which is valuable. The Torah needs protection. Not because it's going to go away, but if we don't treat it with value, then it's not going to have meaning to us. I'll give you a perfect example. Really, it's probably one of the more famous ones. One of the things that we don't do on Shabbos is we don't write, right? I don't go ahead and I don't write letters. I don't take a pen and I don't write whatever it is, a letter, I write write over my notes on something. It's one of the things that we don't do on Shabbos. Comes along the sages, the Rabbanan, not the Torah itself, and they put a fence around that concern. And they said, don't pick up a pen on Shabbos. On a strictly biblical level, there is no problem with you picking up a pen, holding it, showing everybody, and putting it down. You have violated nothing biblically because the Torah says you can't write. But the sages say, but we got to be smart about this. The vast majority of people, when they pick up a pen, what are they going to do with it? They're going to write with it. Therefore, to safeguard the actual prohibition of writing, we're going to build a fence. We're going to tell everybody take two steps back. We do that at camp when we have a bonfire, when we do a big Havdalah, and you have a campfire. We don't let everybody sit right there. Everybody take two big steps back, and you put a rope and you cordon it off. Why? Why? It's because if they're 1 foot away from the fire, are they going to get burned necessarily? No, but it's possible now. I don't want anybody getting hurt. So therefore, everybody take two giant steps back. The sages do the same thing. And they say, I understand that the actual prohibition is only the writing. But in order to avoid that, because sometimes we mindlessly, I don't know about you, I play with my pen when I'm holding it. I flip it, I bite it, right? I'm mindless about it. And what happens is that, you start doodling because it's in your hand. But I'm at a meeting and it's a boring meeting, right? It's like a board meeting, right? And what happens is I'll start doodling, right? If I'm holding a pen, I'm going to do something with it. The sages said, but then you're going to run the risk of potentially writing on Shabbos. Therefore, build a fence, take a step back, don't even pick up a pen. Every aspect of the Torah requires some level of safety, some safeguard. Now, could you go ahead and start making up bigger and bigger and bigger safeguards? Yeah, but you have to be smart about it. I don't know if I'll end with it, but this idea, Adam and Eve made this mistake. He did put up a fence, but he went too far with it also. What did God command? This is for you, Susan, in the Garden of Eden. What was the commandment? What did God tell Adam and Eve not to do?
It
Right. Do not eat from that tree of knowledge of good and evil. Correct? When Adam told that over to Eve, when Adam told it to Chava, he put in a safeguard. And he told her, don't eat and don't touch. Don't touch it. Because if you don't touch it, you won't come to eat it. Logically made perfect sense. However, in the course, and we don't have time to do this now, but in the course of the conversation between the serpent and Eve about it, right, at some point, he showed her that touching doesn't have any repercussions. There's no consequences. Look, you touched it and nothing happened. Just like nothing happened when you touched it, nothing will happen when you eat. Now, you can argue and say, but Adam meant it right. All I'm saying, I'm using this as an example, is that you can't build fences that are 100 feet tall. That's not a fence. You've gone too far. Where do you draw the line? That's where we turn to our sages to get guidance on it. But to ignore any fence and to not put up a warning sign whatsoever and just let your 3-year-old, your 5-year-old just walk and play out in the street with no safeguards, nothing. Yeah, play out in the yard. And when the ball goes out there, you have no fence, you have no nothing. You're playing with fire, ladies and gentlemen. You need some kind of safeguard. When something is of importance to you, when something is valuable, you have to put in safeguards. So the men of the Great Assembly, they taught us three lessons in this Mishnah. Number one, be very deliberate and cautious in your judgments. As a judge, if that's your actual position, certainly a judge that we all are between us and others, how we judge people. And make sure that you make proper good judicial decisions for yourself. Number two, make sure that your students, number one, have as many as you can. Teach, give to as many people as you can. Why? You don't know who's going to become the next good one. And teach them to the point they can stand on their own 2 feet. And finally, something of value, something that is of the utmost value, which is the Torah to us. Requires some level of fence, some way to preserve the sanctity of what the Torah is and it not become corrupted and even more to become devalued. Like, whatever. It's not a big deal. It is a big deal. You're playing with fire. You have to put up some kind of fence. I'm already over time here. I'll pause here. I may have an insight next week starting with this, but we'll probably move on to number two. Let me open it up if anyone has any thoughts, comments, questions.
Rabbi, so you mentioned the ethics of the like a different like nations and it always changing. So that reminds of the serpent that changes the skin. Just an analogy.
Oh, changes its skin.
Yeah, like a serpent,
Yeah,
and
the
the
chameleon.
serpent that proposed to eat the tree of knowledge of like good and evil, and that is could be associated with judgment, because you need to know what is good and what is evil, and that could be changing in the different
Right? That's why you do
cultures and
need,
times.
you have to have an objective truth.
Yeah, which is Torah.
Good point. Good point. Robin.
I don't know. I might have missed it, or maybe we didn't get that into it because it was towards the end. But how do you make a safety fence around the Torah? You were saying us that we need to protect the Torah, but how do you do that, I
We can
guess?
do it. That's a great question. And we can do it. There's two layers here. There's for me, the individual. Like, for example, you budget, you put up a safety guard, right? You don't want to miss this class at 8 o'clock. What do you do to make sure? How do you make sure? Because you get busy. You set an alarm, don't you?
Just look at the clock, right?
I set an alarm so I'm not late to my own class, right? You want, if something's important to you, you set a safeguard. You make sure, right? I give the example. I know that I want to give tzedakah. Everybody wants to give tzedakah. Everybody wants to give money to help other people. But what do you do to make sure? What safeguard do you put in place? So I've shared with you in the past the idea of two checking accounts. And every time we get a paycheck, a certain percentage I put in my tzedakah account. That's a safeguard because then when the opportunity is there, I got the money to give it. I don't have to look and see. It's the end of the month. I don't know. I put in safeguards. If something's important to me, you come up with strategies of how you're going to make sure you stay on task. That's on the individual level. When it comes to protecting the Torah itself, our sages did this for us. Our sages built in many, many times. People ask me, well, can I do that? Well, the answer is no. Where does it say it in the Torah? I say, you're right. It's a rabbinic thing. Well, where do the rabbis come off to? What they're trying to do is exactly this point. They're trying to put in safeguards to protect the actual Torah. Again, I go back to the pen. There is no problem in and of itself holding a pen on Shabbos. But, and there are many, many such examples of where safeguards are put in. For example, in many, many circles, I don't know if it's true in all circles, but there's many people that when Rosh Hashanah, the first day falls out on Shabbos, as it did I think last year, not this past year, but the one before, the many people in their synagogues, they won't blow shofar on the first day, and they'll only blow it on the second day. Why? The Torah says that on the 10th, on the first of Tishrei, on the first of that month, you are to blow the shofar. Yom Teruah. It's a day of blowing. And yet, we don't do it. The Torah doesn't say if it falls out on Shabbos, don't do it. Doesn't say that. So how come we don't do it? Think about it.
Is
It's
it the
massive. Who made that decision? That's saying the Torah says do X. And somebody came along and said, don't do X. Whoa. Somebody's got to have some seriously broad shoulders to make a statement like that. Imagine if I came to you, Robin, and I said, hey, guess what? The Torah says you got to keep Shabbos. You got to keep kosher. And I come along and I say, well, if Shabbos falls on Tuesday, you don't have to do it. Right? Okay, that's obviously hysterical, right? Shabbos can't fall on Tuesday. But, right, if I came along and but that is exactly what the sages did. Why? They made a rule that when Shabbos, I mean, when Rosh Hashanah falls down on Shabbos, not to blow the shofar. Why?
Is it
Because,
because of the
oh,
carrying object?
yes, because there was a concern that in many, many communities, not like it is today, most communities did not have an Eruv, did not have this communal connection that allows you to carry. One of the 39 categories of forbidden labor on Shabbos is carrying from one domain to another. And there was a definite concern that people would want to know and learn how to blow shofar. So they would take their shofar and they would walk in the public domain carrying a shofar, which is a big no-no. So the rabbis enacted a fence and they said it's better to protect Shabbos and not blow on when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, don't blow, only blow the next day. But the concept is the same idea, is where you want to protect the item itself, that is Shabbos. Shabbos is a critical aspect of Torah observance. To protect it, they said it's better not to blow it on Rosh Hashanah than to carry it. That's a fence. I could, Tzvi Tachem could never come up with something like that. No way. These were the sages who understood the bigger picture.
You're saying the rabbis and the sages are the ones that put the fence around the Torah.
Yes, in many, many instances, they built those safeguards. And that's how we follow it. But understand why. And I think that's really what our Mishnah is telling us. The need to have a fence for the Torah. That's really the thrust. I don't think the Mishnah is trying to give us a directive. Go ahead and make 100 more fences around the. I don't think that's what the Mishnah is telling us. The Mishnah is telling us there is a need. Why? Because the Torah is of such value. It's worth more than your diamond ring that you would never just leave out when you had, strangers coming to visit, or you go away and you let someone stay in your house. There's no chance you're leaving that stuff out. You don't know them. You build a fence because it's so valuable to you. The Torah needs to be so valuable, we're not willing. We're even willing to put up fences that are a step beyond what we have to do. Why? Because I don't want to get to a situation that I actually violate what's in the Torah. That's what I think the thrust of the Mishnah is. Yes, Susan.
It feels like these three are like so much scaffolding and bedrock at the starting gate for what may come. And I'll need this week to think about that even more, but it feels like in each of them, there is important bedrock guidance. That I'm sure will be, carried forward. And so part of my question is, I'll be interested in kind of seeing as we proceed, whatever the teachings are, how the connection, why they're put together,
Yes.
because this just to me feels so cohesive and so important at this starting
Well,
gate.
you're right. I don't want to say I'm embarrassed, but I have literally tens of books, all on Pirkei Avos. And there are so many takes on it. This is one, it's very good. His whole message, it's called Successful Jewish Living. Okay? It's insight just in the first chapter. The whole book is all about connections and patterns within the first chapter. And you're right. Every commentary is dealing with why these three statements. I promise you, the men of the Great Assembly said more than three things, but these became like their pet phrases. What is it that they're, yes, and maybe some of the Mishnayos will go through what is the connection between the three. In fact, we probably should also, if we can, discuss why that particular author liked those three ideas. Was there something going on in his life that taught him that, and therefore that became his motto, that became his mantra? There's multiple levels. It's only an hour class. I already pushed you an hour and 20, you know? There's only so much.
Who wrote that book you were just showing us? Probably lost it again.
His name is Rabbi Rothbard, Rotbard. Avraham Rothbard. I don't know much about him. I mean, I don't know. It's like one of those things I picked up years ago. I don't know. Yeah, and he put it together based on a lecture by someone else. You know, there's literally, I don't think it's as many as the Haggadah, but it's pretty darn close. All right. All right. I'll let you guys go. All right. We'll pick this up, God willing. We'll shoot for number two next week. But I'll try to remember to send out a link. But for those of you who did follow the link, you should be able to just keep following. It's got all of them. So, but I'll try to remember to send it out next week. It went. All right. Have a great rest of the week, everybody.
Thank
Thank you,
you.
Rabbi.